How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We're here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts as we are every Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline, USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, and streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. And as is the case every Sunday, we have tons of news to talk about. We are going to recap the WWE's biggest pay-per-view of the summer, SummerSlam, last Sunday. Show went off the air last week with us talking about the show and the card and my expectations that Brock Lesnar was going to pin Hunter was going to pin Brock Lesnar clean in the middle of the ring with a pedigree. That did not happen. Brock Lesnar not only beat Triple H at SummerSlam last week, he broke his arm in storyline clean in the middle of the ring with the Kimura, which, it appears, is setting up a rematch between the two, perhaps at Survivor Series. We're going to talk more about that later on in this program, plus the biggest news of the last couple of days. This coming Saturday night, UFC 151 canceled. John Jones refused to take a fight with Chael Sonnen after Dan Henderson suffered a torn MCL. And when Jones was offered the fight with an untrained Sonnen, he said no. And Dana White ended up canceling the pay-per-view. The John Jones fight has been moved. That is not all. Jones was then scheduled to face Lyoto Machida at UFC 152. And surprise, surprise, after making the announcement, Lyoto Machida said, "I don't want the fight." John Jones has been vilified. He has apologized profusely. I don't think it has done him any good. We're going to talk about the entire wacky situation here in the first hour of the show. In addition to that and SummerSlam in hour two, we are going to discuss the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame voting season is upon us. Mike Sempervivi and I are going to run down the list of candidates and give our thoughts on a few of the top prospects, including one John Cena. It's going to be quite a show today, everybody, so stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, as we are every Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. Got a lot of news to talk about here in hour one, and we're going to kick it off with a UFC pay-per-view cancellation 8 days before the event. Very quickly, what happened was Dan Henderson was scheduled to face Johnny Bones Jones for the title this coming Saturday night in Las Vegas at UFC 151. And Dan Henderson, a couple of weeks back, while training, rumored to be with Sokaju, but we don't have that confirmed, he blew out his knee. And he suffered a partial tear of the MCL. He tried to gut it out. Turned out he was not going to be able to compete. He didn't have a lot of stability in the knee. He found that even when he got a dominant position, his knee instability made it very difficult to maintain his position. He felt he would not be able to compete. He called Dana White. Dana White, upon hearing this news, began looking for a replacement for Dan Henderson. He called one Chael Sonnen. This being after Lyoto Machida and Shogun Hua both turned down the fight for this coming Saturday night. So he called Chael Sonnen, who, of course, is coming off a loss to Anderson Silva in a different weight class, although Chael is now moving to 205. He called Chael. "Chael, are you interested in fighting next Saturday?" Chael said, "Absolutely." Dana said, "I'll get back to you." Dana calls Jones, says, "You'll be fighting Chael Sonnen next Saturday." Jones speaks to his management team, including Greg Jackson, and the response ends up being, "No, we will not fight Chael Sonnen." Greg Jackson explained that, "We have been training for Dan Henderson, and to prepare for another opponent with 3 days' notice because, of course, the last week of a fighting cycle, you're largely doing press and taking your week off. So he had 3 hard days of training left. And they felt that it would be ridiculous for him to take a fight on 3 days' notice. Never mind the fact that Chael Sonnen is essentially taking the fight on no day's notice. And Jones had at least been training for a fight. Still turned it down. Dana White, as a result, canceled the entire event. In a press conference on Thursday, an outraged Dana White explained the entire situation and announced that Jones would now be defending his title at UFC 152 instead against Lyoto Machida, the number one contender. Apparently, he announced this before clearing this with Lyoto Machida. Machida ended up turning down the fight. 3 weeks was not enough time to prepare for Bones Jones in a title match. Shogun turned down the fight as well. So, as it stands at this moment, UFC 151 is now, in the words of Dana White, a, quote, murdered event. John Jones and Greg Jackson, he said, murdered that pay-per-view. For trivia purposes in the future, UFC 151 never happened. UFC 152 in Toronto will now be headlined by John Jones versus Vitor Belfort. Belfort being an underdog, plus 700. John Jones, minus 1,300 in the odds. Now, keep in mind, the last time there were odds this long, it was Matt Serra versus GSP, and Matt Serra won that fight in a gigantic upset. So I find these odds to be preposterous. But suffice to say, that is the new fight. Everybody hates John Jones. The fighters are outraged. Many of them have lost out on payouts. They've lost out on an extra fight in a cycle. Some of the guys scheduled to fight in September are not fighting until December, which means they could have had 2 fights in that period. Now they're only getting 1, so they're missing out on an entire fighting cycle. A lot of outrage. Mike Sempervivi, my man, what do you think of this situation?
Times have certainly changed, haven't they? John Jones is getting vilified, and if you look at this from a pure sporting point of view, people don't realize what the outrage is all about. Why would you be vilifying John Jones? He was training for someone else. He was, given a guy with no notice and had it thrown in his face and then was berated by Dana White when he didn't take it. And when you look at that from an outsider's point of view or a non-fight fan's point of view, the average person on the street would say, these were unreasonable demands put on John Jones, and he had every right to not take the fight. The thing is, for everyone that's actually followed mixed martial arts over the years, and, this isn't a pride type of thing where, they would pull bait and switches on guys at the last minute and things like that. This was a honest attempt to try to save a pay-per-view, and most fans are looking at it as, well, you were training to face a wrestler who was much bigger than the guy you would be fighting, and because he's much smaller and has not fought at 205 pounds before. He was not training. Even if you lose this fight, you have a built-in excuse, and you're facing a guy who just happens to have a huge mouth that may drive up pay-per-view buys, which would increase your bottom line. And just the fact that there's a tradition when it comes to mixed martial arts fighters that you fight. That's what you do. You go out there and fight. And many of them have said that. Ronda Rousey has said that. Chael obviously went on with you and Dave after the press conference on Wednesday afternoon and talked about it, or on Thursday afternoon, and you guys talked about it. And that fighters fight, and that's been the tradition in mixed martial arts. But times, I guess, are changing a little bit. I mean, Ed Soares and Anderson Silva have played with Dana White because they've been able to use their leverage. Greg Jackson, obviously, has been a thorn in Dana White's side in some ways. And John Jones, who is a fighter that is sponsored by the UFC, not something Dana White is happy about, but he is sponsored by the UFC. I think Dana looked at it as, you almost have to do this because, you're representing us, and that's what we're all about. But in this new era of fighters and of management and these types of things getting into mixed martial arts, John Jones may be looking at this from his brother's point of views in the NFL. You wouldn't put this on any other athlete and anything else. But also the drawback of that is that's what's killing boxing, and what has killed boxing is guys don't want to fight each other. They use leverage. They back out of stuff. And you don't want to see that happen in the UFC. So very interesting, because you can't really say John Jones is wrong, even though you can say John Jones is wrong.
Well, that was an interesting statement right there.
Well, I mean, I'm probably overthinking this a little bit, but there's a big, you know, kind of sports sociological thing going on here, and watching this change kind of take place when it comes to MMA. I mean, it's very interesting.
Jones, as Dana White noted, is the first champion he's ever had who was training for a fight, and the opponent pulled out, and the champion was offered someone who was going to have no notice to take the fight, and the champion said no. Now, it should be noted, there are conspiracy theorists out there who believe, based on following Chael's Twitter, and when Chael started going on the warpath, that Chael was well aware that Dan Henderson wasn't going to be able to fight, and expected to get the call to fight Jones, meaning he actually had been training for a while, and the whole story about how I'm untrained is not true. Now, maybe that's true. The problem with the story is that Chael was not, nor would he have been, called first. Chael had to know that if Dan Henderson couldn't take the fight, the very first person they were going to call would have been Lyoto Machida, who has publicly been begging for the fight. And that there are probably others in the light heavyweight division that would have been called before Chael, particularly since Dana White had made it clear that Chael was going to have to probably win two or three fights before he got a shot at John Jones. So maybe there's something to it. Maybe Chael had a better handle on this than people expected. But I find it hard to believe that Chael was expecting the call to take this fight 3 weeks ago and got into intense training at that point in order to take it. The whole idea of Jones turning down this fight, I could talk about this more in the next segment because I'm running up against a break. The whole thing is preposterous given the switch of opponents. In fact, I'm gonna take this break right now. I'm going to talk about this when we come back. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live, everybody, here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, not the least of which is the John Jones situation with the cancellation of UFC 151. Before the break, I was talking about the entire mindset of turning down a fight with Chael Sonnen. Chael Sonnen, John Jones was training for Dan Henderson. Now, granted, Dan Henderson, while a wrestler, has another strength, perhaps a greater strength, some would argue, that being his right hand, his power punch. And he is, however, it is, you know, he is a wrestler. And Jones would have been going from a wrestler with a power punch, a wrestler who is, in fact, and can be a finisher, to Chael Sonnen, also a wrestler, who would have no time to train, conceivably, and is not known as a finisher with a power right hand. So I don't understand the whole idea of I was training for one guy and now I'd have to prepare for another guy. What is Chael Sonnen, untrained, going to bring to the table that Dan Henderson would not have brought? Dan was either going to try and take you down and maul you, or he was going to try and knock you out. Okay, of those two options, Chael is not going to try and knock you out. He's probably going to try and take you down to the ground and pound you out. But he tried to pound out Anderson Silva for 5 rounds and couldn't get the job done. So you really think that an untrained Chael Sonnen is going to last 5 rounds with John Jones? I'm not even sure what the concern was here about this fight.
And, you know, Dan Henderson is, you know, in my eyes, he's not, you know, the first guy I put in, but I would say if there's a Hall of Fame for mixed martial arts one day, he deserves his spot in, and he's most certainly not done. And he is incredibly dangerous and did provide more, you know, far more risk than I believe Chael Sonnen would. And at the end of the day, what has the UFC always been good in doing for guys who step up to the bat for them? They always take care of them. They take care of them financially behind the scenes. They take care of them by giving them more fights than maybe they deserve because they're on a losing streak. they always take care of you. Why would John Jones think that the UFC, who was sponsoring him, would not take care of him if something happened with Sonnen, if he was embarrassed? And really, even if he was, I'm not saying that that would be the best thing for him or anything like that, but with that said, a rematch against Chael would be monstrous as well. And again, I know he doesn't want to lose, and that's not the way a fighter would think going in as well. Man, maybe if I lose, I can get a rematch out of the deal. Well, unless you're Timothy Bradley, who I think had that idea with Manny Pacquiao earlier this year. He just happened to accidentally win the fight. I just, with all the physical gifts John Jones has, with everything that goes into it, I am really surprised that they didn't just jump on this opportunity to, I'm not saying that he'd be able to notch off Chael and that Chael wouldn't bring something to the table, but I would take John Jones in that fight, and I think he would have won impressively. And I think I may be coming too much from the old school here of someone who watched Pride and everything and came up this way, and I'm trying to look at it from the other point of view as well, but it's just tough. If I were John Jones, I would have taken the fight, and I'm surprised that he didn't.
I'm just trying to figure out the psychology of this, because let's imagine, I would guess that if it were up to John Jones, he would have just taken the fight with Chael. I actually do believe that.
Same here.
I would guess that his handlers told him, don't take this fight, it would be foolish of you. But let's just say that Jones or his handlers think that Chael Sonnen is too dangerous an opponent and that he could beat John Jones. Let's just pretend that they have that mindset. If that's the case, why would you not take this fight now? Because, you know, if you turn down this fight, which John Jones did, Chael stepped up to the plate, and when UFC called, without hesitation, he said, yes, I will take this fight with no training. I will fly to Las Vegas tomorrow, and I will get in that octagon and fight John Jones. So you know that because of that, they're going to give Chael a fight with Jones at the earliest available opportunity, which means Chael is going to get a full 12-week training camp, which means you're actually going to get, presumably, a healthy, trained, ready-to-fight Chael Sonnen, because you turned him down. Whereas if you would have just taken the fight, as I think Dana White may have used this, maybe it was Dave that used this statement, but it may have been Dana. Chael was handed to Jones on a silver platter. Here is an untrained Chael Sonnen. So if there is any real legitimate concern about Chael as a fighter, it was absolutely foolish of them to turn down the fight when he was going in there with no training. Because they're guaranteed to be given the fight later with Chael getting a full training camp. Now, on the other hand, if you're not worried about Chael, if you think that Jones is going to beat Chael handily, then why didn't you take the fight? I cannot conceive of a reason for them not taking this fight with Chael Sonnen.
No, and that's exactly it. You know, it's just, you know, why didn't you take the fight then with him? You know, what was the need to throw yourself off schedule now? You know, because initially the fight with Machida was going to be September 22nd, which, you know, obviously that didn't end up happening, and now you're getting Vitor Belfort, but still, and it's just, I don't know. I mean, Jones said that, you know, the Machida rematch, and he said this before all this went down, would be, you know, the low reward, high risk. You know, got to go in there and face Machida again, and man, I already beat the guy, and it's like, you know, well, you're going to run out of opponents anyway, and people, you know, he's the probably the most promoted, least popular star that they have, and I don't know, Dana White, you know, I agree with actually a lot of things, you know, his emotion in the press conference, I was completely fine with that when he, you know, threw that one out there about kind of, you know, burying a guy you promote, though. You probably should be a little bit more careful that way, but I don't know. It's just, again, it's almost like, you know, when pro wrestlers started to get lawyers and they started to get, like, you know, what was the guy's name? Barry Bloom and these managers and different guys who made them look at things from a different point of view and put demands on WCW and WWE, and maybe that's a little bit of this starting here with MMA. Again, you know, Ed Soares and Anderson Silva have done this with the UFC and with Dana White. And it'll be just be interesting to see how much, you know, Greg Jackson decides to do things like this. And if it's just, you know, looking at things from a different, more of a quote unquote pure sports way to look at things, I wonder how much that's going to continue to come into the UFC and how they're going to continue to deal with it. I do feel bad for all the fighters, though, that have been moved around, because that's one thing where they've gone back and forth over that. And John Jones, like, well, Dana canceled the card, and Dana turns around to John Jones and goes, well, you know, if you would have taken the fight, you know, these guys would actually be getting paid. And
well, I will say, I hate to cut you off, but I will say, Jones, I don't know if you saw it today, he did send out a tweet this afternoon, and I'm sure he slept on it. I'm sure he's gotten a lot of feedback. Jones today did say, I will take full responsibility for what happened. I apologize to everybody. I'm so sorry this happened. It was not my intention, and I apologize. So he did do that.
So he should have taken the... That tells me you should have taken the fight then, which then, you know, Greg Jackson's the biggest heel in this whole thing then.
Well, here's there are a couple things I'm not entirely sure about, and I don't know the answer to them. Number one, if you listen to the Dana White press conference, I mean, he was absolutely infuriated. I wonder if he made it clear to Jones and his camp, if you don't take this fight, I'm canceling the card. You know, that actually is a very important question, because if I'm Greg Jackson or John Jones and I'm having a talk with Dana, and they ask me, or they ask Jones to take the fight, and myself as Greg Jackson or John Jones, we say, no, we don't want to take this fight. You know, if Dana just says, you got to take the fight, I'm not taking blah, 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 and you just have this back and forth, and Dana never says, if you don't take this fight, I'm canceling the whole show. They shouldn't have expected him to cancel the whole show. You know what I mean? So if I honest to God think that Dana had to have told them that, because he was so infuriated about the whole thing, that I can't imagine him not saying, Jones, if you guys don't take this fight, I'm canceling the whole card. I have to think he did that, but I don't know. Maybe he didn't. So I really don't know if I can really blame them for that. I mean, if he never made it clear he would cancel the fight, I don't know. You know, would they really have expected him to cancel an entire pay-per-view a week out because they said no to Chael Sonnen?
If you're going to do that sort of thing and to you know, and again, Greg Jackson's doing his job, you know, as far as representing his fighter, whether you agree with him or not, that's his job and that's his, you know, advising, and that's what he is there to do. At least when it comes to John Jones, as well as training him, you know, acting as, you know, somewhat of an agent here for him. He's doing what he's supposed to do. But with that said, you have to think of all the possibilities of what could happen, because they got Chael. You got a guy, not even a 205-pound guy. They knew the other guys were offered that fight before Chael. And so obviously it's getting to ground zero here, because God knows who else you're going to throw in that spot. You can't put Gustafson in there. You can't do any other moves. What did they think was going to happen? They were rolling into a pay-per-view in Toronto that would have had a main event of who? Do you even know? I can't even remember.
The main event of Toronto?
Yeah.
Was the flyweight, 125-pound decision match.
Well, I'm sorry, Las Vegas. Not the best.
Oh, Vegas, I can't even remember the semi-main.
Yeah, exactly. So they had to, I mean, this was like a ground zero type of thing. And yeah, I guess, yes, it's unprecedented. And yes, Dana White had always bragged about the fact that they had never, you know, done this. But with that said, I mean, if you're going to do all of this and think about all this, if you're Greg Jackson, you have to figure they're down to a nuclear situation as far as getting a fighter to take my man. Is it possible they do pull the plug?
The other question, which I don't have answered, and we can get your, I don't even know if we can even get your opinion, because we don't know the answer unless you've heard something. Jones has stated publicly in the past that he would fight Chael anytime, anywhere. And then, of course, they turned down the fight with Chael. The question I have is, when Jones turned down the fight, okay, he said that afternoon after turning it down, if Chael wants to fight at the end of September, I'll fight him then. I don't know if they asked Jones to fight him at the end of September and what he said. That's a big question. We'll talk about that more after the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live, Sports Byline, Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Sports Byline, USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208. Streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. And for the latest news and information in pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, you can always head to our website, WrestlingObserver.com. We have daily news updates and literally, I don't know how this is even possible to measure, but more radio shows than you could shake a stick at. We literally have tens of thousands of hours of audio in the archives. We do radio shows pretty much every single day. And in fact, if you go up to WrestlingObserver.com right now, if you'd like a sample, first off, it sounds exactly like the show you're listening to right now. Download the MP3s to your device. Listen to it on the way to work, when you get caught in traffic, when you take walks, when you go to the gym, wherever you listen to your audio. You can check out the latest in pro wrestling and mixed martial arts talk with myself, Dave Meltzer, Mike Sempervivi, all of our different radio show hosts. And if you go up to WrestlingObserver.com right now for another sample, scroll down, and we have a free, absolutely free, radio interview with Chael Sonnen discussing the John Jones situation from a couple of days ago. It's just one of thousands and thousands of shows available in the archives. $10.99 a month. That is the subscription price. Less than a couple of cups of coffee at Starbucks. $10.99 a month. Not only does that get you all of the brand new radio shows that we do every day, every week, ad nauseum, but it gets you full access to our archives. Every show we have ever done, dating back to 2005, is available in the archives right now. So check it out. We got free shows. If you scroll down the right-hand side of the page, check them out. And if you like what you hear, sign up. I guarantee you, if you love this show, Wrestling Observer Live, I guarantee that you will love a subscription to WrestlingObserver.com. So try it out. Give it a shot for a month. If you don't like it, you never have to sign up again. But most of the people who have given it a shot, subscribers for life. So check it out. You'll enjoy it. Now, on the John Jones situation, before the break, and we're going to switch to SummerSlam here in a moment, but the big question to me is, Jones has claimed in the past he'd fight Chael anytime, anywhere. Option came up, the opportunity, he turned it down. That afternoon, he stated that, well, if Chael wants to fight me at the end of September, I'd be happy to take that fight. This was before it turned out that Lyoto Machida pulled out. So, my question, which as of yet has been unanswered, is when Machida pulled out, did Dana say, well, Jones, will you take Chael Sonnen at the end of September? And did John Jones say no? I don't have an answer to that question, but I do know at the end of September, he's not facing Chael Sonnen. He's facing Vitor Belfort, who is plus 700. Jones is minus 1,300. Preposterous odds. Mike, what do you make of all of this?
That could be the case, or it could have just been that Dana, at that point, having the time, and then, the silver lining in this is, realistically, Toronto gets a card that people will actually now want to pay for. And again, that's nothing against Johnson and Benavidez, because I forget who it is at now, 125. I mean, the lower weight divisions are great, but this was not, again, they've been to Toronto now a couple times. The shine's off a little bit, and it was not looking like a mega, A-plus type of card. Now with John Jones on it, it does boost the card up. And it does help immensely. And granted, they've lost a lot of money in advertising and the lost revenue and the whole nine yards there. And Vegas is pissed at them. But, the silver lining is that Toronto show now just got a whole lot better. And I think with the time that got bought, Dana just figured, okay, we'll get another 205-pound fighter. And yes, it fell through with Machida. And then, whoever else that they had asked before, Shogun or whoever, and then settling on Belfort. Because Sonnen's got a match set up already with Forrest Griffin, which, from a matchmaking point of view, was going to be, can Forrest, is there anything left in his tank? Is he completely insane? How will he do against, Chael, who is stepping up, and, he's never known to be a dramatically great punch taker, and Forrest has got some pop, and he's moving to 205. So you have a story there, too, and you give Griffin a chance to actually step up a little bit, and you have Jones out there with somebody, and you again, he's going to run out of opponents. So, you know, again, to have somebody in the tank, you know, sitting back a little bit, I don't think that's a bad move to have Chael that way. So I think in that may have just been at the end there. You know, we'll get another person at 205 because now we have the time to look around a little bit.
But minus 1,300.
Well, look, I love odds like that because, you know, I last week with Kedzie and Tate, I thought the odds were way too long with Kedzie, like plus 380. And it's like, you know, hey, if you have $200, you know, I'm not guaranteeing a win here, but throw it on her. And, you know, she, you know, looked very good. And this is another one of those things where, you know, the odds are so long, you know, and what did you say that Belfort is? Plus 650?
I think it's plus 7.
If he's plus,
I find him
again. If you have $50 or $100, you know, why not throw it on him? You know, don't buy Starbucks lattes that week, and you know, don't play lottery or something like that. And you know, you might as well put it on there because, as you said with Sarah and GSP, you know, crazy stuff happens, and those odds, those Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson. I mean, those are the types of odds
plus 750.
Yes, they bait you to throw money on. And again, John Jones will probably kill Vitor Belfort. But again, from a pure gambling point of view, if you got 50 or 100 to throw around, you might as well throw it on a dog at that level.
I don't know. I just think, I guess the exact term that Joey Odessa used were, you can't, what did he say? You can't make a line high enough for the fight. And it's like... How long have you been doing this, dude? I know this is your job, but as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the last time a fight had odds this long, it was GSP versus Matt Serra, and Matt Serra won.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no such thing as there's not a line high enough. I mean, it's a fight. Anything could happen. John Jones could go in there and have a heart attack. I don't know. Something can anything can happen. Minus 1,300 is just like, to me, it's just preposterous.
It really is, and it also shows a, you know, a lack of interest there too, because the thing has not dramatically moved either. And you know, granted, it always moves, you know, a lot closer to the fight, but you know, you usually see some, you know, variation when you see the line first, you know, put up with money rushing one way or another, and doesn't seem like anybody's really moving on this.
Look at this fifth round here. Underdog favorite Vitor Belfort is currently plus 700. And John Jones minus 1,200.
Go ahead. I dare you. Go ahead. Put $1,200 up on John Jones to win 100. I dare you.
Yeah. We'll talk about that one. Yeah. So gambling 101 here. Bet $100 on Vitor. And if he's victorious, you win $700.
Yeah.
Or bet $1,200 on Belfort. And he's victorious, you win $100.
I'll pass. I think somebody's there's going to be lots of parlay betting on that night with tying some things together.
My God. Well, there you go, everybody. All right, let's talk about SummerSlam. Were you...
You should have bet on that.
Bet on SummerSlam? I'm glad I didn't.
I stuck to my guns the entire time, ever since this match was announced, and... You know, it may have been for all of the wrong reasons, but I just could not fathom Triple H being so stupid as to not lay down for Brock Lesnar. A little shaken by the fact, though, that he's going to have to get that win back.
You do realize that Monday they're already getting ready to start setting up this rematch.
I know, and that's what was the incredible painful part of this. And I guess I should have seen it coming, but really, you know, it was kind of depressing at the end of SummerSlam when Triple H was getting up slowly and expecting to get the crowd response, and you know, they pull back on the shot and the crowd is looking down on him, and you know, he's expecting them to chant his name and stand up and applaud, and instead, very audibly in a dead silent Staples Center, you hear people chanting, "You tapped out."
That was kind of
funny,
interesting to say the least. I had heard Survivor Series initially for the rematch, but the more I think about it, I believe the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view is going to be taking place in October. I could be wrong. Now's a good time to check out Google here. But I wouldn't be surprised if they did Hell in a Cell for the Undertaker match. Or, I'm sorry, the Triple H-Lesnar match. I realize that you shouldn't put a Brock Lesnar match on a B show. We've learned that. But they don't learn anything. Hell in a Cell is... what date is it here? I'm trying to find it. Hell in a Cell 2012 pay-per-view poster here. No date, of course. Thank you for that, WWE. But whenever that show takes place, I think that would be a... I think I can see them doing the rematch there. Hunter getting his win back. It is interesting because Brock is on a very limited number of dates, so it'll be interesting to see how they set this up. He's claimed he's retired. I think that's a way to get him off television so Paul can do all the promos until it's time to bring him back. But I don't know. Is it better or worse that he beat Hunter and then Hunter's going to get his win back? Or does it not matter?
I guess it doesn't matter. It doesn't make any sense that I think they wasted two of Brock's appearances. Actually, I take that back. The one right before the show I thought was good with being up Shawn Michaels, but the one before that, they wasted him. And why did you do this then if it was just for Triple H to go ahead and get the win back? I mean, it's just, I don't know. There's no flow to it because Brock Lesnar's going to be gone, and then he comes back, and now we're supposed to care about Triple H getting his revenge on him. And, you know, I don't know. It's, again, I just wish they would kind of move on from it and we would get Brock and Triple H, or Brock and The Undertaker, or Brock and somebody, I guess, when he came back at the Royal Rumble.
All right, so Hell in a Cell is October 28th, Phillips Arena, Atlanta, Georgia. So, could they set that up for 2 months from now? August, September, yeah, 2 months. Is that enough time for a broken arm to heal? I don't know.
Well, he did it in a week the last time around, right?
That's true, that's true. So, as noted, the build for this rematch, expected rematch, is going to start on Raw on Monday night, another three-hour show. And we've also got the build for Night of Champions, which is taking place September 16th. What did you think overall of the SummerSlam show?
It was kind of a mixed bag for me. There were a lot of pleasant surprises, like Daniel Bryan getting the clean win on Kane, and I thought, I'm not a big Miz fan, but I thought he and Mysterio was good, and I thought it ended well. The Sheamus Del Rio thing in another era would be fine, you know, and I really have liked Sheamus throughout the last, year or so. I thought he's improved greatly and I think done a lot of good things, but people were not spending $50 to get that finish and it was convoluted and they were pissed off and it just, you know, it was a little bit rough. So, I mean, the good parts were really good, but the bad parts really kind of stunk. But I'm also, a proponent of keeping Punk champion until he were to face off against The Rock. So, again, the ending of that, I thought, was very good, too. So, can't really complain about it, although for $50, was it worth it if you missed it to get the replay? Probably not.
Well, the Night of Champions is coming up, and Punk is putting the title on the line almost certainly against John Cena. And it is in Boston. It is in John Cena's hometown. And as we talked about last week, there has been discussion, at least, of the idea of putting the belt on John Cena and switching everything up a little bit, where instead of The Rock versus CM Punk at the Royal Rumble and The Rock versus John Cena at WrestleMania, you switch it up and you do John Cena beating Punk here, and John Cena versus The Rock takes place at the Rumble, and then The Rock wins the title, and it's Rock versus CM Punk at WrestleMania. What are the Todd's odds that this happens? We'll discuss it after the break. Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. I ran myself up writing It's My Own Break in the last segment. Professional. What do you think about that, Mike? I channeled I channeled Hulk Hogan when he was attacking Aces and Eights right there.
Remember Elvis did that one time, too, where he was doing his, Are You Lonely Tonight speech, and he's blah, 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 plus tax.
So what do you think, Mike?
I don't know.
What do you think of the idea of Punk and The Rock at Mania instead of the Royal Rumble?
Yeah, I like it a lot. Again, you don't need Austin for this WrestleMania, although it would be great icing on the cake, if you got Punk and Austin and everything. But if they decide to do that, then you know, it really locks in that whoever Undertaker is facing in the New York market is going to be, the main event of that show. It's no slight to Punk and to Rock, but I think you have all the excuse in the world then. If it's, you know, I doubt it would be Triple H again against The Undertaker, but if you do Lesnar and The Undertaker or something like that, I think that would be the best possible way to close that show. I think if it's Cena and Rock, though, I think you have to do the rematch as kind of the main event there.
I think if you're going to do Rock and Cena at Mania, obviously Cena can't win the title in Boston. And maybe they'll, I don't know what they'll do. CM Punk goes full-fledged, 100% heel, finally, and screws him out of the title or something like that. And you make it even mean more when Cena's going for the title at WrestleMania. I just, I don't know. I'm not into the CM Punk tweener character right now. You know, the guy that he's cutting heel promos, wrestling like a babyface, saying he's not a heel. I feel that leads to fan apathy when they don't know what to think about a guy. What are your thoughts?
I agree, actually, in some ways. I think he's fine doing the role he's doing of being, you know, saying the truthful things, but in a really douchey fashion. I think that's a great thing to do, but him wrestling as a face is annoying, and realistically, it's just do some Dory Funk type of stuff and do just little things Tanahashi does in Japan. Just do some things to make yourself look heelish as you're wrestling, and then...
And then we're going to head to a break. Fine. Back with more Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live, where you're here for the next hour talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, as we are every Sunday. 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. Slow weekend next week as well, since the pay-per-view has been canceled. Murdered is the term that Dana White used. The show is murdered.
In a way, it's a mercy killing for me, because I can rest a little while on Saturday then.
That's right. Dana was very upset at people's claims that, well, you know, if you weren't running so many shows, the undercard wouldn't have sucked so bad that if you lost the main event, you wouldn't have to cancel the show. Very upset with that. Although, I would say there is a little to that. You got so many shows that, as noted, what was the semi-main event of Saturday's show? I don't even remember. I know some of you out there do, but the key is 99.9% of people could not have named the semi-main event. And that is a result of a lot of shows taking place. And when you lose the main event on a show like that, what do you have left? It is interesting that it was canceled, in the sense that, yeah, they didn't have much of a card. Yeah, they weren't going to get a lot of buys. But would that really have been worse than outright canceling the show and all that money that you put into it is now for naught? What would you have done, Mike?
Actually, yeah. The way it went down, I'm actually for them canceling it because of the fact that they had such a weak card. And, you know, I think they should maybe run a little less shows, but I think the structure of what they do with these shows is their biggest problem. I mean, Donald Cerrone and Alexander Gustafsson have both, you know, been the main events on Fuel shows. Why? You know, that should be, you know, nobody gets the channel. That should be the one you don't do a whole lot with. And, again, they tend to create their own problems this way, but also with the injuries and everything else, it makes it tough on Joe Silva.
All right, we're going to head to a break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's time to talk the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We're back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, as we are every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, and streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. We are here talking the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. It is election time. Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame is probably the number one real-life, honest-to-God, legitimate Hall of Fame in the world. And I'm going to read a little bit of this as far as what the criteria is according to Dave Meltzer. It is, of course, based on the Baseball Hall of Fame, Football Hall of Fame, etc. And I'm going to read some of this, and then we'll get into some of the names here. It says the basic criteria for the Hall of Fame is a combination of drawing power, being a great in-ring performer, as well as having historical significance in a positive manner. A candidate should have something to offer in all three categories, or be someone so strong in one or two of these categories that they deserve inclusion. Names listed below are under consideration to be eligible. A performer must have reached their 35th birthday and completed 10 years since their debut as a full-time performer, or be someone who has been a full-time pro wrestler for at least 15 years. Longevity should be prime consideration rather than a hot 2 or 3 year run, unless someone is so significant as a trendsetter or a historical figure in the business or valuable to the industry that they should be included. However, just longevity without being either a long-term main event or top draw and or top caliber worker should be seen as relatively meaningless. Election is broken down into categories. You should check each category for wrestlers that you feel you are familiar enough with based on geography that you've either traveled or are familiar with, and based on the time that you have followed pro wrestling. You do not have to vote for a wrestler in every category that you have checked. Maximum number of wrestlers you can vote for is 10. Combined, you can pick as few as 0 if you don't believe anyone on this list deserves inclusion. A separate category for non-wrestlers, those being executives, managers, announcers, other out-of-the-ring performers, you can vote in them or not. Those choices are not included against the 10-wrestler maximum. Anyone receives mention on 60% of the ballot from their geographical reason and time frame, broken down in a number of categories, will be added to the Hall of Fame this year. If you're unfamiliar with the candidates, that is fine. Ballots are sent to many people all over the world and from different wrestling cultures so that everyone has as fair a shot as possible. Breakdown for modern and historical is 30 years ago or 1982. So if the last year the performer was a headliner or was a key figure in the industry was prior to 1982, they will be in the historical class. If a performer receives between 10 and 59.9% of the ballots, they will remain on the ballot for next year. Less than 10% will be dropped from the ballot. And then in 2 years, if there is significant feedback from voters who say they will vote for them, they will be put back on. So, with all that said, let's look at some of these performers, the most notable of which, Mike, eligible for induction this year, is John Cena. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's one of those where there's going to be a lot of people who have been, you know, longtime voters in the Hall of Fame that have been voting for other guys for a long time, and John Cena is a slam dunk selection. On the Japanese side, Hiroshi Tanahashi is kind of the same way. I mean, they're both kind of generational rivals. Obviously, Cena being much, much bigger because he's in WWE, but kind of the same situation where these guys' stories have not been, you know, completely written yet. They have much to do and much to accomplish and to see what happens. But both of them, you'd have to figure they're not going to nosedive to the point where they're, you know, everything will be wiped out, previous to them getting in. So I would say vote them both in. The only problem is there's only 10 spots available, and there are guys, you know, and we're going to go through some of them here where, you know, it's nothing against John Cena or Hiroshi Tanahashi, especially Cena, but, you know, maybe they just don't make it on a lot of guys' ballots just because there's other people that other guys have been voting for years that, you know, will go ahead and take their spots. But I think in Cena's case, there's enough voters and, you know, there's enough spots on most people's ballots where I think he is going to go in. And realistically, he's a no-brainer, too. So, I don't think anyone can argue that John Cena does not belong on a professional wrestling Hall of Fame. They may not like him, but you look at the money, you look at the ratings, you look at the merchandise, you look at the impact on, you know, kids as far as, you know, being one of the few guys that actually garners legitimate emotion, either pro or con. John Cena definitely belongs in the Hall of Fame.
I think that I talked to Carl Stern, actually. We did a Hall of Fame show. And Carl Stern's one of those guys that thinks that 35 is too young to go in. He wants to wait longer to see how John Cena, the rest of his career, pans out before he votes for him. He doesn't like voting for people in the prime of their career. And he is, of course, he can vote for whoever he wants to. But to me, the only person in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame where you can argue that we should have waited to vote for this man because of what happened was Chris Benoit. And I don't think there's ever going to be another Chris Benoit situation in the history of this business. To me, John Cena has had such a career thus far that he literally would have to do something. I don't know what he would have to do. I mean, like I said, I don't think John Cena is ever going to do anything like Chris Benoit did. What would John Cena have to do where everything that he has accomplished so far in his career would be such that he's no longer considered a Hall of Famer? I can't think of anything outside of a horrific, horrible, homicidal rampage like what Chris Benoit went on. So, to me, here are the requirements. A combination of drawing power, being a great in-ring performer, and having historical significance in a positive manner. I'm sure some people would try to argue that John Cena's historical significance is a negative just because they don't like the PG era, but that's not John Cena's fault. He is not responsible for PG. John Cena, per the criteria, is an absolute 100% Hall of Famer, perhaps more than anybody else on this list. He is the face of a current generation of professional wrestling. And I don't know. I mean, to me, if you're going to take this thing seriously and you're going to vote based on the criteria, then you put John Cena on your ballot. That's just my opinion. And you can argue anybody else here, but to exclude John Cena from your ballot, I don't even know what your reasoning can be. And my guess is it's reasoning, it's qualifications that you have created for yourself for the Hall of Fame. And to me, that's not the way you should vote. You should vote based on what is required of you per the actual requirements on the ballot. And to me, John Cena just, he has to go in.
I think even more than Chris Benoit, who, again, went nuts. He just went nuts. Triple H is another one where, if you think about it, something could happen to Vince McMahon. It's Triple H and Stephanie's show, and they do something that gets them kicked off. I think this is all crazy, you know, but what if he implodes WWE? Do you have a recall to kick it and changes the wrestling business as we know in the worst possible way? Then what? Do we have a recall vote for him, too? It's kind of interesting that way, but I agree with you 100% when it comes to John Cena. How do you not put him in? It's just, again, the only thing you can say, and this is where I think the Hall of Fame is bad in being based off of baseballs, is that if some may have the mentality that baseball writers do where nobody deserves to go in their first ballot. You know, and nobody's ever had a unanimous vote into the Baseball Hall of Fame. That doesn't make any sense. And it's writers who, or historians or whoever it is, taking themselves too seriously, or other workers in the business, and or taking out a grudge on someone. Again, that would be the only way that John Cena doesn't go in under the criteria.
Now, another interesting name for modern listeners is Edge. And Edge was always interesting to me because Edge had a very, very similar career to Chris Jericho. Jericho's career was longer. Jericho wrestled in different companies all over the world. But really, they had similar careers. And Jericho is in, and Edge is questionable. I'm going to get your thoughts on him when we come back from the break. Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are talking the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame balloting, which is going on as we speak for the 2012 Hall of Fame class for the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And we are discussing various candidates here, and the one we are currently talking about is Edge. And as I noted before the break, Edge and Chris Jericho have a lot in common. Certain things are obviously different. Jericho has had a longer career. Jericho worked in Japan and Mexico and WCW, WWE. Edge, as far as WWE title reigns, he probably was pushed a little bit harder than Chris Jericho during a period where at one point he was the face of a brand on SmackDown, for example, which was arguably the weaker brand. Not arguably, it was definitely the weaker brand. And, you know, you can make certain comparisons about what titles meant when and whether the undisputed title reign that Jericho had, he was largely just a setup guy for Triple H winning it back. But he did beat The Rock and Steve Austin. There are a lot of different ways you can argue this, but they did have two rather similar careers. And interestingly enough, Chris Jericho has gone into the WWE or the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And Edge has not gotten nearly the number of votes. And Mike, where do you fall in this debate?
You know, the only reason he wouldn't be on my ballot is just that there's too many other names that I would put on before him, and not that I'm against Edge, because I don't think you can hold it against Edge that he is, you know, as we talk about like the Rock and Roll Express or Sergeant Slaughter or guys from other eras, Edge, he came up in the WWE system. You can't hold it against him that he had so many title reigns and titles don't mean anything, that he didn't travel and all that other stuff. He was a superstar. You know, again, not to the level of John Cena, but to me, just underneath of that, the way people reacted to him, you know, and again, you know, that's, you can't take it out on that he's a product of the system, because in the system that he was in, he flourished and he got legitimate, you know, emotional responses. And that's something, how many guys have that? I mean, even more so than Jericho, I believe. You know, outside of Cena and Orton, I mean, who got it? You know, Batista got it to a certain degree, but Edge was a beloved, you know, superstar for that company. And I think, again, you can't hold it against him that he's a, you know, arena draw or some things like that. I just don't, it's hard when it comes to WWE, because the whole is presented as being much, much greater than the sum of its parts, and the parts that have talent don't get to necessarily showcase that talent all the time enough to, you know, what could be, you know, what we think about as a traditional sports Hall of Fame career. So, again, I see myself voting for Edge down the line. In a way, Sting is like this, too. I can see myself voting for Sting, but to me there are guys who deserve it more right now who I've been voting for a while. So I think that's what's ultimately keeping him off my ballot, because I've kind of cut mine to 20, and he's not actually on it.
Here's a very interesting name. Brock Lesnar. Now, it doesn't specify anywhere in here what to do with a guy like Brock Lesnar. Do you count his mixed martial arts UFC run? If you do, I think he is a Hall of Famer, for sure. If you don't count that, then I don't think that he's a Hall of Famer. Now, granted, if the SummerSlam numbers are through the roof and WrestleMania and Survivor Series, if he wrestles Triple H there, are through the roof, you know, maybe next year at this time I'll reconsider that statement. But what is interesting about this is, even if you're somebody who doesn't consider Brock's exploits as being deserving of discussion and whether or not he deserves to be in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, what is interesting about Brock Lesnar's UFC run is that Brock Lesnar was the number one the number one pay-per-view draw for at least 2-3 years there. Every time Brock was on a UFC pay-per-view, the numbers were gigantic. Now, that was due in large part to wrestling fans buying UFC pay-per-views to watch Brock Lesnar fight. So, to me, even if you don't normally consider a person's MMA exploits as counting towards their Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame voting criteria, in Brock's case, I could almost argue that even if you don't normally do that, you should in this case. Because Brock was a guy that, even though he was doing real fights, he was drawing all of the pro wrestling fans to watching his pay-per-views. He remained a pro wrestling draw even outside of pro wrestling, because it was the same audience. So to me, because of the impact that he had on MMA buy rates, in good part, not fully, but in good part because of pro wrestling fans buying UFC pay-per-views whenever he was fighting, I argue that you should count his UFC run as part of his personal criteria, and therefore I would vote Brock Lesnar into the Observer Hall of Fame.
Boy, but then could you just put him in a class like Jesse Ventura, though, where, you know, obviously he had a noted pro wrestling career, but it would be going into the Hall of Fame based on things he did outside of pro wrestling, drawing, you know, people to vote for him and drawing interest in him.
Do you really think that Ventura, I mean, maybe someone would argue this, but do you really think that he was voted into the office by pro wrestling fans?
You know, that was a really weird election where, you know, he legitimately got people to vote for him and energized people that had never voted before or were looking for such a dramatic change. And really, his stint as the mayor of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, I don't think really impacted his, you know, running for governorship more than the pro wrestling did.
Well, you could argue that. I personally would not give Ventura's public... I would not see Ventura running and becoming governor and all of his political victories. I would not attribute that. Well, I don't know.
Linda.
It's different because Brock continued drawing the same audience to essentially watch the same stuff. The only difference was the finishes were not predetermined. Brock was like a pro wrestler the entire time. He just jumped from one company to another. The same fans were watching him in both companies. It was exactly the same, except for his finishes were not predetermined. That's the only difference, really, in the case of Brock Lesnar.
See, and my argument against that is it's just the time, because if this was taking place in 99, 2000, you know, in that era, I would actually say yes, but I think Brock belongs, or can be argued that he belongs in MMA Hall of Fame. I just, you know, if he could do more and did more and was more consistent and, you know, stuck around for a little bit longer and came back to wrestling even semi-regularly, I would say yes, because used right, I mean, he is a Hall of Fame caliber guy and talent that energizes people and can be interesting. Now, I don't think they've done it with this run, but I think if he were to continue to do it on a semi-regular basis, I would say yes. I just think it's too much of a supernova, and I think it may sound, you know, two-faced to say this, but I think it's just not that I'm excusing it for Ken Shamrock or somebody in back in the day. I just think times are different enough now where I'm not going to give Brock the pro wrestling credit for what he did in MMA, because all three of the sports are basically promoted the same. So, I mean, not essentially you're going to get the same fans, and he does deserve credit for drawing pro wrestling fans, but essentially you're promoting all of these things in the same exact way. So to say he brought, you know, the pro wrestling to the table in that notoriety, I mean, you should be promoting fights like that anyway.
Yeah, but so in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, do you feel that Kazushi Sakuraba should be in the Hall of Fame?
For pro wrestling? No.
No, just the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
It's a loaded, you know, but if you're going with that and you back me into that corner, then yes. You know, because I know what you're including into that, but if you were looking at this, because I don't, you know, I know people have good feelings about him with UWFI and that run in New Japan where there was Takada and there were all these other guys and they were doing that shoot-style thing. Those matches, Takada's did and there were a few guys that did. Sakuraba's never amazed me. Now, the pro wrestling shtick that he brought to Pride, of course, the Gracie Killer. I mean, everything that had happened there and, you know, obviously the pro wrestling nature of that promotion. Yeah, if you're including everything, then Sakuraba belongs in, which means Brock Lesnar does too, because he was a supernova for both. But I'm looking at this from a purely pro wrestling point of view.
I don't know. I guess we'd have to talk to Dave. I don't really. I mean, it doesn't specify in the wrestling. At one point, there was a Wrestling Observer MMA Hall of Fame. And there was a lack of interest, so it was dropped. But what is a Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame now? You know.
Well, look, I think there should be categories, and I've brought this up to Dave, or at least I've written to him before, because you could have a category that includes that influence that you put, you know, Takata and Lesnar. And, you know, some of the guys like Kiyoshi, Tamura, and Volkan, you know, they fit into that category. And you know what? You know, you could say that there's a place for that, and I definitely would accept it.
Well, Funaki, Masakatsu Funaki is in here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's another name. And, you know, and that's completely fair. And I think that's something that could be explored more later on, too. I mean, think about Kevin Dunn for everybody that hates him. But as far as the revolution of how we look at professional wrestling, would he one day deserve a spot, even though people hate his guts? You know, I mean, is there enough influence there where you put him in some sort of category? Bill Apter, same way.
I just feel personally, as we go to the break here, that if you've got some of these individuals in here, if you've got the Kazushi Sakuraba, who is in fact in the Observer Hall of Fame, and you've got Masakatsu Funaki, I believe that Brock Lesnar should go in as well. We'll talk more about this after the break. Wrestling Observer, live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We're here for the next 20 minutes talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, as we are every Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet. At WrestlingObserver.com, we are here talking about the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. We were talking Brock Lesnar. Does he deserve to go into the Observer Hall of Fame? What exactly is the criteria if you are a man who has done both pro wrestling and mixed martial arts? And I should note, in the case of Kazushi Sakuraba, wrestling in Japan, as you're well aware, Mike, and the mixed martial arts scene in Japan was, in fact, different than it is here in the United States. Here in the United States, there's pro wrestling and there's mixed martial arts. In Japan, Sakuraba, when he was at his peak as a mixed martial arts fighter, he was considered a pro wrestler. And that is why he was always included as a pro wrestler in discussions in the Observer. Yes, here in America, we did not consider him a pro wrestler when he was doing those mixed martial arts fights. But those in Japan, the people in Japan, when he was fighting in Japan, in Japanese mixed martial arts fights, he was considered a professional wrestler. And so, therefore, when in Japan. So, that's the argument
but
for...
Here's the thing with that, though, and the only thing I would say, too, is now that we know, in hindsight, and things are a lot more clear, I mean, Josh Barnett, I mean, that's why Josh Barnett is announced as a pro wrestler before his Strikeforce fights, because it stems from that era. But I think, you know, times were also different, where I think everything has kind of shaken out and cleared out enough to know, okay, you know, again, I know why those guys are in, and it makes sense to me, but I think it was from another time that you can't say just because they're in, Brock deserves to be in because of that. I don't think that it necessarily balances itself out.
No, but as I said, in my belief is that Brock Lesnar, and I'm not even saying, I mean, there are a lot of guys, there are a ton of guys. Listen, there are a ton of guys in UFC that were professional wrestlers. And you mentioned Josh Barnett. Josh Barnett is a professional wrestler who does mixed martial arts. Or you can argue he's a mixed martial arts, he does pro wrestling, whatever. But when Josh Barnett fights, he's not drawing pro wrestling fans. And Brock Lesnar drew pro wrestling fans from 1999 or 2000 or whenever it was he broke into WWE. I mean, you mentioned Supernova, but Brock Lesnar has been doing this as long as John Cena, with the exception of the period of time where he was trying out to become a football player. But, you know, he's largely had the exact same amount of time as John Cena. And during that period, he has consistently, the whole time, drawn wrestling fans to his matches. Whether they were real fights or fake fights, he has been a professional wrestling draw the entire time. And you cannot say that about any other pro wrestlers in the United States that are doing mixed martial arts right now. Bobby Lashley fights, nobody watches. But Brock Lesnar is a guy, he was a pro wrestling draw almost the exact same amount of time that John Cena has been, and he still is to this day. And to me, drawing all of those eyeballs to pro wrestling and particularly the UFC for those 3 years, that to me is he deserves to be in the Observer Hall of Fame, in my opinion. Now, going back to Japan, since you mentioned Tanahashi, I want to get your thoughts on Kensuke Sasaki.
You know, he's that board. I'm not saying he's Dick Murdoch, because I think Sasaki's going to make it in, if not this year. It's going to be very soon. He's hard to hold down when you look at other guys in the Hall of Fame and you start making comparisons. I mean, that company was strapped to his back in 1997. He wins the G1. He lays waste to Tenzan, who's an established guy, wins the tag titles, wins the heavyweight title from Hashimoto, blows through Hashimoto's generational friends in Chono and Muda, which was a big deal, and you know he rolled on and he had a monster year, and he's kept up with that, and he's been an effective guy even today, running his own shows. He's been a guy that when guys companies bring him in, he does spike excitement. Now there's only so much you can spike the gate in Japan anymore, but he's one of those guys that garners legitimate interest, and his work obviously training guys. The most notable one being there, he and Akira Hokuto's adopted son, Katsuhiko Nakajima, I think is strengthened his cause. And, there was and I know it's in the Ring of Hell book, and I don't know a whole lot about it. There was a misfortune, at a training at a dojo where, I guess Sasaki beating up a guy a little bit ended up possibly leading to the guy's death. And I know, much like in the case of Carlos Colon, there are some people that are holding that against Sasaki, but I think when you look at the whole of his career, and I don't know exactly, again, what went on with that, so I can't judge it. At the end of the day, when you look at his pro wrestling career in Japan, what he meant to New Japan, and how his legacy has gone on, I think he definitely deserves a spot in the Hall of Fame. And again, it just comes down to on my ballot this year, whether he... it's just going to be one of the last 10, but I think there's no doubt that he belongs into the Hall of Fame at some point.
The TNA Hall of Fame has got one individual in it, Sting. He's being inducted officially at Slammiversary. And in fact, it appears that Christian, they are bringing back Christian to induct him into the Hall of Fame, which... I understand. I think it's pretty cool to have a WWE guy come back and do this, but seriously, Christian, why? But anyway,
he was so happy last time around.
I know he was overjoyed to be there doing this. But anyway, given the last few years of his career in TNA, and granted, it's TNA, it's a distant number two, but he is still a star. He's treated as a legend, and he's been a main eventer now for a long, long time. Has he moved numbers? Probably not. You can look at some TNA pay-per-views and, he has bumped buy rates before from like 9,000 to 12,000. He has made a difference. Not much of a difference, but he has made a difference. As each year goes by, personally, the more I think that Sting needs to be in the Hall of Fame. And I know you can point to a lot of different reasons why he shouldn't be in there, but he's one of those guys where, to me, it is a Hall of Fame. And this guy was a huge star during the biggest era in the history of wrestling in this country, the Monday Night Wars. He was one half of the biggest buy rate that WCW ever did. And it was not his fault they screwed that entire thing up afterwards. He stood in the rafters for a year, and he popped the biggest buy rate they've ever done in his match with Hulk Hogan. And, of course, the whole thing went underwater afterwards. But if you are a fan in your 30s or 40s, if you've been a fan since childhood, I mean, again, you can point to a lot of reasons why If you look at individual things like how much money did the guy draw, how much did he really pop attendance, this, that, and the other thing, you can make arguments why he shouldn't be in. But if you're a fan in your 30s or 40s, you've been watching this since you were a child, you look at the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame and Sting isn't in it, and to me, it's weird. And that's, I have no better argument than that to me, it is a Hall of Fame, and to me, Sting should be in it. He is a huge, endearing star, and he's a guy that everybody that grew up watching wrestling and was a teenager or a young adult during the Monday Night Wars, and anyone who's a fan throughout the 80s and 90s, Sting not being in is just weird. And I know that's a horrible argument, but I know there are a lot of people listening to this right now that know what I'm saying. And I don't know if you're one of them, Mike. Probably not, but that's my argument.
Considering we're about the same age, yeah, I actually know exactly what you're talking about. And I think, you know, again, do I think this? I could go on a rant here of why I believe the Sharp brothers need to be in the Hall of Fame over Sting. And there's 10 other guys I think are as well. But again, will I vote Sting in one day? I can see it happening. Do I think overall will voters do it? Yeah. I think the historians will never give him the credit. I think maybe the writers won't. But as you look back, I think there's people that will end up giving him the votes to get in the Hall of Fame because everybody's kind of the same. Sting couldn't cut an interview that was any good. Sting didn't really have a whole lot of wrestling moves.
Actually, that's changed in the last 3 years. He does great promos nowadays.
But the whole thing is, even though for all of his misgivings and shortcomings when it came to professional wrestling and you know what he was supposed to be doing, people didn't care. And, you know, they just didn't care. And in an era where The Rock comes back, they get a 3-1. Brock Lesnar comes back, they get a 3-1. Undertaker, 3-1. Jericho, 3-1. When all of these guys, nothing's moving the needle now. Yes, Lex Luger and Sting were not the draws that WCW really wanted them to be. But really, in hindsight, when you look back and you kind of compare things, I don't think history is going to judge it to be as bad as maybe some people look at it right now. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I just think that there's going to be voters down the line, no matter how long it takes, that go pretty much in saying the same thing. We're talking about Sting, whatever it is, 10 years from now. Why the hell is this guy not in? Everybody likes Sting.
Yeah, I feel that as the years go by, more and more voters are going to look at this list and go, why isn't Sting in the Hall of Fame? And it will make less sense to them as years go by. And I think, you know, if you watch a lot of TNA, I know that TNA is like, it's such a distant number two that I think a lot of people, like, I can't picture anybody ever voting AJ Styles into the Hall of Fame because his entire career has taken place in TNA. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. You can make that decision. But Sting has had a hell of a run over the last several years in TNA. He's won the title. He's been a main eventer. He has moved their numbers ever so slightly. However somebody can move numbers, Sting and Jeff Hardy have moved them for TNA. And I just remember back a couple years ago when they did that Undertaker video before WrestleMania, and everybody thought it was a video for Sting. And I just remember on the internet, everybody was so excited at the possibility that Sting was going to come in and wrestle The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And I don't know how many people know this, but when they cut that commercial, they had no intentions of bringing in Sting, talking to Sting, or nothing like that. But the internet went so crazy at the thought that it was a video for Sting that they actually contacted Sting and said, "You want to talk?" And a deal didn't end up getting made, but the reason that happened, the reason people got so excited on the internet about the possibility of that match was because it was going to be Undertaker versus Sting. Because it's Sting. And there are a lot of people that think that Sting is a really big deal. And to me, it's the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, and Sting should be in the Hall of Fame. Because he's Sting. But we'll see what happens. You could argue that about other people here as well, though. So,
hey, intangibles. That's when intangibles come into play.
He is the king of intangibles to me on this ballot. You know, I'm sure there are other guys that people feel that same way about, but he's just one of those names where you like go down the list and you're like, yeah, I can see people making an argument here for Hans Schmidt and John Tolos and the Rock and Roll Express, which I've made an argument for every single year. But you come down to Sting, and it's like, this guy should just be in the Hall of Fame, you know? But we'll see what happens. I a couple of years ago, I wouldn't have made that argument. But each year that goes by, I think more and more that the guy deserves to go in. So we'll see what happens with the voters. They've got a limited number of votes, and his career is not yet over. So we'll see how it goes. We're actually up against a break, so we are going to head to that. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. Final moments of the show. We've been talking about the Observer Hall of Fame, and Mike, earlier you were talking about the Sharp Brothers. You got 1 minute to convince us they should go in.
You know what? The first big superstars in Japan, everybody talks about the Destroyer and Freddie Blassie and Lou Thesz, all of which are true, and they faced off against Rick Adozan. But when Rick Adozan came to America, the guys, when he went back, he took the Sharp Brothers with him. And the Sharp Brothers were like the original, you know, 50s tag team champions. I mean, there's not a whole lot of film on them because they spent their, you know, career in San Francisco for the most part, where we got a chance to see the Kangaroos and the Grahams and the Bastines and everybody on the East Coast. We had a chance to see those guys, but we didn't have a chance to see the Sharps, and they, you know, drew huge TV ratings in Japan. They were the tag team in America between the 50s and the 60s. I mean, there were some other ones, but they were the kind of the original tag team champions, held the belts 18 times in Japan or in San Francisco for the Joe Malkiewicz promotion. And I honestly believe that they deserve to be in there. I mean, they did well touring, even though they spent most of their career out there, but it opened up, you know, Western Canada to them, Hawaii, Los Angeles. And again, tag teams are woefully underrepresented in the Hall of Fame. And again, you wouldn't have, you know, they helped to be one of the cornerstones for Japanese wrestling and had, you know, great matches and did well in San Francisco. So they've kind of been forgotten about, but I think they deserve to be in there. And I think the Assassins and the Andersons do as well. Just again, tag teams are woefully underrepresented, and the Assassins were very close to getting in last year, and I think they probably deserve to get in this year.
All right, everybody, we are totally out of time. It is the end of summer. I'm going to be heading to a summer vacation, beautiful Cannon Beach, Oregon, but the work never stops. We're going to be back next week live from the beach, as we will all this week at WrestlingObserver.com. Brand new shows every single day. Sign up and check it out. You won't regret it. So again, next Sunday we'll be back. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, Mike, all the listeners, everybody involved here at Sports Byline USA. Talk to you again next week, listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network.